Venezuela in 2008, and I went to a coffee cooperative. Farmers who used to work for some big capitalist or big landlord have their own co-op now, and they produce their own coffee, and it's distributed locally. And I asked them about, well, what about nationally? And they said, nationally, there's about four families that control the distribution of almost all the coffee in the country. I was thinking about that. Last night I was watching a film on the food revolution in Venezuela that was made like 2011. And I think Roman Carmacaro was one of the people who advised that, who you might know in New York.
That's the homie.
And they were talking about how they were building food sovereignty in Venezuela and the food independence and a self-sustaining food, making agriculturally independent country. And we can see now that that didn't happen. But I think, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of cooperatives like you were at, but I still think that when it comes down to it, the capitalists who still control the distribution system in the country can undermine and wreak havoc on all the cooperatives and all these things that people are building from below, because they're the top, they still control all the distribution. I mean, people below not only got to produce on their own, but they have to set up their own distribution networks also.
So the brother was telling me, so he had all these like containers, right? And I was like, yo, Franco, where you get all these containers from, man? These are like official containers. And he was like, yo, I got a little hookup of this dude. He works at the Johnson & Johnson company, right? So he was telling me the story. He's like, man, we rolled up there like, yo, we heard you got the Johnson & Johnson, whatever. And that they were like, no, there's none here for you. So then he said he called up his man like, yo, I thought you told me that I had the hookup. He's like, no, you got to go tell this guy and talk to this guy and talk to that dude. So long story short, he went and spoke to that dude. And he ended up getting access to hundreds of containers that originally he was told there's no containers. And so what I say is that is a dilemma that they're facing, is that they don't have access to, like, they're still... You know, and there's still capitalism that's still thriving in Venezuela. You know what I mean? The revolution didn't exactly take them all out. You know what I mean? That may be a discussion for another day. You know what I'm saying? But as a result of that, they don't have, like you said, the distribution. You know what I mean? Or not only distribution, but even access to the containers. You know what I mean? That some of the larger, factories have. And I think that's been something that they've been facing, you know what I mean, that they don't have national levels of distribution yet. And I guess that to me, I just kind of question, like, even within, like, for example, like, is that how many years do you really need to reverse capitalism fully? You know what I mean? And so I think that, like, what we're showing here is an example of a small cooperative that I'm sure there's many of cooperatives all over Venezuela, but I'm sure that they're all facing similar ceilings, you can say, of how much they can actually grow, you know. Like, even when I told them, like, I spoke to this dude at the hotel, and I was like, man, I got you. You need 1,000. I called up Franco. He was like, you're crazy as hell. We're going to have to go crazy to get 1,000, you know. He was going to make it happen. But I'm over here playing salesman, like, yeah, they got detergent. And he was like, nosotros con suerte te podemos producir 300. Like, you know, with luck, I could probably give you 300, you know? Mm-hmm. And so just seeing that level of distribution they couldn't meet without it being a struggle was also a reality check.
And also going back to the idea you were saying that in a lot of ways we have to stop thinking about it as what is the result going to be. You know, I mean, I doubt that there's the idea that, oh, you know, we're going to be able to compete with a Johnson & Johnson or compete with any of these, you know, multinationals that, like you said, have an abundant amount of resources. They have the capabilities to shut down entire infrastructures that are related to producing some of these products. But at the same time, I think for a lot of them, and including these homies, it's the process. The process aspect of it is almost as important than what the results are going to be. And if, you know, like over here, we have the concept of, you know, things becoming big enough where they're too big to fail, right? Like the banks, right? And this, again, is challenging. And I think that they're, when they're looking at new forms of social organization, it's even challenging that concept of, do we need to have, you know, these giant, you know, distributors of soaps and hygiene products? What would a system look like of different smaller cooperatives networked together? And again, like you said, I think you're right in the sense of there's still an element where you're dealing with these multinationals that still have the power, even within a sovereign nation, even within a revolutionary process like in Venezuela, where there still is the power to be able to shut down certain infrastructure. And that's, again, that's the economic war that's being waged. Brother in the back.
Hey.
Peace.
My name is Craig Sosi. I come from the Navajo Nation of New Mexico. I've been at the Standing Rock fight for in North Dakota for the last 6 months. And one thing that we were always talking about is to beat the corporations, the bigger corporations, is we have to start it. We have to buy from our community. We have to start a community. Okay, if you want to, you know, like get rid of the big corporations, then you just stop. You know, ask the people. Don't spend them. Go back to your community. Spend to the farmers that are here. I work with an organization out of Albuquerque. And we have our own farms, our own community farms there. And we have a co-op where they sell their produce.
Is that the one that sells it to the school system?
That's La Plazita.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Anyways, you sell, you know, and you put it out there. So we buy from there. You know, just like here in Chicago, I was just talking to Carlos right here. I said, you know, we have to start something. If we're going to start, we got to start small. And we have to do it ourselves. We can't be going to Walmart. We can't be going to all these big corporations. You know, our main thing for the Oshetti Shakoi movement is that we're divesting out of all these big banks and going back into our community banks, our credit unions, because we have the control over the credit union. So, you know, it comes back to what you're talking about. How do we get rid of these big corporations controlling everything? Well, we have to go back to, we're going to have to spend a little bit more money, you know, paying the farmer this. But it goes back into his pocket. Not into these big farms that are way out there. Because that's one of the things that we've been talking about. You know, this is our way of doing things. You know, as a native person, you know, we're trying to go back into that, our traditional way of life. Because we're spending too much money with these big corporations. You know, our president, you know, he made his money doing what he's doing. He's got these big buildings. What are they used for? If you really look at it, they're just housing people. You know, all these people that are making that big money, living in these apartment complexes inside these high-rise buildings, they're pretty much in the prison system. Because they don't understand. We, as indigenous people, we understand the importance of land, the importance of clean water, the importance of all the things that we need in life, you know. And that, it goes back to every country throughout Turtle Island, throughout Ujimaka, Mother Earth. We're all hurting for that, what you're talking about, you know. You have your fight there. We have our fight there. But it's all a fight together, you know. We're all expressing ourselves. This is the reason why I'm here with the Indigenous Youth Council. This is the reason why I'm here with the Pilsen Alliance. This is the reason why I'm with the Illinois Water Protectors. I stand for Oshetti Shakoi, but we try to get together, and this is why we came here, why I came here, because of this. I want to listen, I want to hear, you know. To learn the struggles and the fights, but we have to all get together with instead of if we are all fighting different fronts, it's harder. You know, so you know, I'm putting myself out there, just saying, you know, this is where we got to start. We got to talk about it. You know, the more we talk about it, the more we get together, the more we organize and figure out where everybody's at, we can beat the system. Because there's more of us on the ground than there are in those corporations. Only 1%, maybe 2% that live in those high rises, you know, that have the money. But the rest of us are here. We're not poor. Exactly, we're not poor because we have our culture. We have our teachings. We have a mom and a dad. That makes us probably the richest people in your life. We might be struggling, you know, trying to feed each other, but, you know, come together as family. You think about it. You probably can go to your family and they, man, the food comes out real good. You watch the features of the white people. And I don't like to use that word, but the people that live up there, they don't have a place. They don't have a mom and a dad to go to, run to. When they're out of food, they're out of food. You know, we all came together help support each other. This young man right here comes from the Cheyenne River, Sioux Tribe. This young man comes from down in Mexico. My sister here. We all know where we're at, but we're all brothers and sisters. So that's one of the things that I just wanted to say is that as long as we work together and we put all our knowledge together, we will beat the system.
Appreciate that, brother. Definitely. My brother with the glasses in the back.
Yeah, I want to say, building on what he's saying, that you shouldn't be so pessimistic that there are no results since Ferguson. The big support for Standing Rock, thousands of people going there, taking up struggles in the various communities against the banks that have invested in the DAPL pipeline, the big opposition in city after city against the police misconduct and crimes and killings, and people demanding that this stop and that there be community control is a definite thinking and development and result. And there have been thousands of demonstrations, both during the Obama administration and now with Trump, and a major slogan is we want democracy. We want to become the decision makers and not have the oligarchs running things. And there's a lot of discussion and debate. This is a very positive result. And people go out to hear Rebel Diaz because they want to hear the content of what you say. They look at the lyrics, whatever. What is the problem here in the U.S.? What is the problem with the system? What can we do? People are thinking and discussing. That's a very positive result and shouldn't be underplayed. So it's part of a process that has to develop. It's a very positive beginning. I wanted to emphasize that in terms of how we develop things in the U.S. is very important, and there's a lot of positive aspects to it.
Just to speak to that, I think that for sure. I mean, we're in a good moment. Anytime people are worried about what their future looks like and feeling like they can have a say, and feeling like if it means hitting the streets, if it means going to a protest, to a meeting, anytime you have that aperture, I think is an opportune moment to be able to agitate, to organize, to educate. So I agree with you on that for sure, that there has been victories as a result of the mobilizations, of the disruptions taking place. I would just say that I felt like Rob was speaking to more the idea that there's been a history in this country where, and not just here in the United States, but also in terms of U.S. foreign policy, where through NGOs, through universities, there's funding of sometimes both sides of different debates. And you fund the opposition and your side in order to then create chaos and then be able to enact legislation that is going against the people. And we've seen that time and time again. I think what you were speaking to earlier is post-2014, we haven't had, you know, legislation, for example, that protects, you know, the black people being killed on the streets, that protects the indigenous nations having their land taken away. On the contrary, the result has been legislations like Blue Lives Matter, state laws throughout the country that are increasing the protection for police officers. And so I think that, and Caro, who's also here today, who works with an awesome base building community organization called Blocks Together, she always says that we got to get over the feel-good moments, the feel-good victories, because, you know, sometimes we see stuff and we're like, you know, yeah, this is it. This is, you know, revolution. You know, I say it for ourselves. When we came back from Ferguson, you know, we came back and telling all the elders, like, yo, this is going down. Like, this is, you know, this is it. This is the revolution is tomorrow. And I think that, you know, lessons learned, because we realize also that a lot of the energy, unfortunately, from these different mobilizations was channeled towards, you know, the nonprofits, towards putting people on the university lecture circuit, or, you know, talking heads on CNN because, hey, you know, you seem to talk nice, let's put you on TV, but then we take you out of your community where the organic building was being done. So I think that that's really what we were speaking to. But I definitely see a point in terms of right now being an important moment where there's an opening, because people are, you know, like looking up like, wait a minute, something is wrong. So I definitely feel that. The sister in the back, I'm going to get right to you, but I know you've been, I just want to get the sisters involved too. Yes.
We have, like, had these moments of, like, real solidarity and stuff after Ferguson and Standing Rock and, like, huge numbers, but what's missing is that actual, the building part that you talked about earlier. Yeah, we're together and I see all of you guys and we're talking, but how are we giving all of these people who are now involved the tools to actually go ahead and create something outside of the system that we're trying to get out of, right? So, like, this guy is making his own business that gives back to the community. How are we bringing that kind of building so that people can see a way out of the way things are working now? So, like, we have the masses and we're having this conversation, but now that work of building that house together has to begin. And so that's the part that's missing, and that's where I think we're walking towards.
Definitely. That's an awesome contribution. One of the things that Rob mentioned earlier was, you know, the lessons that we came back with in terms of the ideas of communications, and that it being a communal thing. Too often we just, even when we put out, you know, information, because when we do events, when we do protests, we're promoting them. We want people to go. We want people to come gather. The more people, the better. And sometimes in that communication, it's really just giving of information or just agitation. But what happens after that protest? Where is the organic that's being built? And I think that's what you're speaking to, like, what's that next step, you know, beyond? And again, I always go back to this idea that it has to be not just on the ideological territory, but also the physical territory, the importance, my brother, that you mentioned of the connection to the land, you know what I'm saying? And in our situations here in urban areas, connections to our neighborhoods. And in the era, you know, of displacement, what does that look like to maintain those lassos in our community, those connections? But definitely feel your point for sure. The brother here has been waiting. Go ahead, man.
I was just very interested in what you were presenting from Venezuela, because I think it's broadening the definition of revolution, you know, and understanding their different expressions of it. And, you know, it's not like you're posing building cooperatives is going to take power. You know, it's a cooperation thing where there's a struggle to take power, there's a struggle to fight the bourgeois media, and there's a struggle to create. And I think that's very important, because one of the things that happened in Cuba was before the Soviet Union collapsed, there were a number of organic farmers who were developing ways of farming that was different and seemingly not as productive. But when the Soviet Union collapsed and fertilizers were no longer available,
they became the most important.
That was the most important thing. So you can belittle that beforehand, but it's very important to have a broad concept of social revolution and integrate the different aspects. And so I think, you know, what you're bringing back is an important concept. The other thing about communications, which I think is a challenge for us that you're talking about, is having that exchange, but also having it so it's educational and not just different stories, and that's a challenge, you know, not to just lecture, but also to educate each other in a real way. So it's an interesting challenge.
For sure, I appreciate that comment. The brother in the back with the hat.
Yeah, I was just gonna comment, or I guess it's, you know, sort of a question comment. So I know in Venezuela, the U.S. Empire has been having a really hard time exploiting the oil like it used to, because I think some of the corporations were nationalized or something. I haven't like really studied the details of how that's going on, but because of that, I know they've been trying to like kind of get oil from different resources. Like one thing I did hear about was the Koch brothers, right, or whatever they call it. I don't know if you have heard of it, but there's these two guys that own this corporation. They set up their base in Texas, then something happened, they weren't able to get the oil out of Texas or something like that. They needed to get it from Venezuela, but because of the revolution, they weren't gonna be able to profit, right? So then they started trying to figure out how they can get it from Alaska, or how they can, or I think they were also investing in like helping overthrow the Venezuelan government to try to get rid of the leftist government and all that. I haven't really seen though, like anybody make the connection between the Venezuelan Revolution and the Standing Rock situation. But I feel like, I mean, there's a connection there, you know. Like there's, I mean, more pipelines being built in that area. Like in Detroit, also, I met these people from this organization that were fighting against the tar sands oil or something like that, right? Blocking the pipelines and stuff like that. And now, you know, with Standing Rock, with the resistance that was going on there, I haven't really heard of, like, the connection. But I mean, you know, what do y'all think? Do y'all think like
to put it bluntly, that's the main reason that they're not trying to have a revolution live in Venezuela. Real simple. For a oil, whatever, barge to get from the Middle East to the U.S., it could take up to 4 weeks. For oil barge to come from Venezuela, 4 days. That's the reason that the Venezuelan Revolution has been a problem.
What about the connection with Standing Rock?
I'm about to get there. I'm going to try to share. First of all, time-wise, what you're dealing with, you know what I mean? Something as basic as 4 days compared to 4 weeks, right? Historically, Latin America has had its resources pillaged by the United States. In Chile, we had copper. Right, when Allende had his socialist revolution win through the democratic vote, you had companies, the Guyana Copper Company, you had all kind of multinational corporations creating a huge fuss because those resources that they were stealing pretty much were now no longer available to them. The same thing happened for years. Venezuela was getting their oil taken at ridiculous prices. You know what I mean? Like, we took a road trip out there, and I'm used to being in the U.S., and it's something I want to share. And I remember I was like, man, I had like dollars on me. I'm trying to figure out to help out my man. And he's like, oh, we just filled up the tank. And I'm like, how much did it cost? He's like, I don't know, like the equivalent of like 10 cents. You know what I'm saying? That's what the people that live in Venezuela are paying for the oil. Which is, if you think about it, it should be, because it wasn't like that before the revolution. Right? And so what I'm saying is that Venezuela has the third largest oil?
First
largest oil. Like apparently, yes, their oil is good money for man long. Mm-hmm. Like they got oil for years, you know? And that's why the U.S. has got so much money invested in trying to overthrow the revolution, because that's a resource they want, and that a resource that capitalism needs to be able, you know. I think when you look at the connections with what's going on in Standing Rock, is that at the same time, they're trying to figure out new ways of creating energy and new ways of
you know what I mean, transporting that energy, whether it's through pipelines, right? And so I think that what was happening essentially is that capitalism and its greed is consuming itself, you know what I'm saying, to the level that they don't even, they trying to create new ways of moving it around, you know? And so what's happening in Standing Rock, you know, is a result that really they couldn't build the pipeline through, was it Bismarck, the name of the town?
North Bismarck, yeah.
They couldn't build through Bismarck, because, you know, white folks over there, so the islands built it through the middle of indigenous territory, you know? And that's really been the history of you know what I mean? It's no different than when they built the highway through the middle of the Bronx. You know what I'm saying? They weren't going to build a highway through Manhattan.
They
built it through the middle of the Bronx to be able to get, you know. And people got displaced. And there was, you know, even in my area, Hunts Point, we recently found out that there was ancient slave burials right in the middle of the hood. But we never knew about it because our land was destroyed. And so I think that there's, you know, there's many connections that you can make with Standing Rock. People fight for their land, for their resources, you know what I mean, for their history. What's going on in Venezuela isn't that different, you know what I mean?
You think, like, because they can't get the oil so easily now from Venezuela, it's because now, like, now that's why they're so
I don't think that's a direct connection,
no,
per se. But I do think that Venezuela no longer being a resource that they could pillage and pretty much steal from has them trying to, you know, figure out other ways of getting, you know what I mean, getting that. So I don't know if it's direct, you know what I'm saying, because I also know that when they lowered, like, we all remember a couple years ago, oil to fill up your car like $6, crazy numbers, you know, and now it's back to, what is now, what, $1.20?
$2,
you know? I remember 98. It was like 99 cents. You know what I'm saying? And so, we also, the way they play with the market was also a way of strangling Venezuela. You know what I mean? The minute that oil prices dropped, that meant less money for Venezuela. That was also a tactic used to try to, and it was a tactic that the revolution saw the effects of it. It hurt them. It hurt the revolution when oil prices dropped. They knew what they were doing. You know what I'm saying?
I want to make sure, just getting the last couple questions in before we get out of here. The brother and the sister, either order.
I have two questions. You said that Franco had taken over the building. Now, I live in a community, Great Wilson, that is going through the process of gentrification. It's like in the second stage of gentrification. Right, some of the parts are fully gentrified already. Considering how the police is militarizing heavier communities of color, I just wanted to see, like, how did that process happen for your friend? Like, how did they take over to create it into a cultural center?
So I think that there are situations very specific, obviously, to the context of Venezuela, where there has been support of the idea of expropriating and reappropriating land, buildings. Today there's a law that says you can't do squats, but there's also a law that says you can't desalojo,
you can't
evict people. You know what I'm saying? So under that framework, you're still kind of allowing for, you know, the taking over of land or buildings, of expropriating unproductive infrastructure. Our experience here in the States, in the Bronx, we originally had a space that we took over, but we had to legalize it. That's the reality I think you're speaking to here, and where we're dealing with a state that's not supportive or minimal, taking, you know, turning a blind eye towards something that they support. Here, we're dealing with a police state, a military state that defends private property at all costs. So I definitely, you know, see that implementing something like that here is a difficult process. We, for 6 years, we had a space in the Bronx. Go ahead.
I was going to say, there is steps you can take.
Right.
We're beginning to do that on the west side. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of empty buildings, so we're saying,
you know, there's people in this home, and there's people going from homeless people into people's homes. Mm-hmm. So there are steps if you're interested. We're undergoing training right now for our members to begin taking over homes from the West Side.
I would say that from our experience in the Bronx, we learned. We made a mistake that we took a building that wasn't city owned.
Yeah.
And so when you're dealing, if there's anything that this country protects with its law, it's private property. And so we lasted 6 years. You know, we held it down. But ultimately, after talking to mad lawyers, they were all like, you're not going to win this battle. Mm-hmm. So what we would say is identify city owned buildings. Like, I'm convinced that in this city, if you gather neighborhood support, you take a city-owned building, you know what I mean? That real talk, if you put the city on blast and you take it from the city, and you got a right group of people with you, it's a winning.
And Chicago, unlike New York, Chicago actually keeps an inventory that's searchable. There's a database of vacant land, city-owned vacant land, and city-owned vacant properties, which one of our fights in the Bronx in New York originally was like, yo, we don't even know what the city owns. Like, that's step one. Like, let's, you know, identify, yo, who owns that building that's been sitting in our hood empty for the last 10, 15 years? Like, who owns that? There's certain aspects where here it's a little easier because, again, there is already, like, an inventory that's been city-mandated where they have that information publicly available. But I think it is possible. Like Rod said, I think it's about, and I also think that it can be reckless to do it without properly developing a nucleus initially, you know what I'm saying, where there's a process of political education where, you know, you have a collective of people that are committed to it and are willing to take the risks that entails, you know what I'm saying? But I wouldn't say it's impossible. Yeah. The brother, you wanted to say something? And then we'll finish with.
No, compañero, hace tiempo tiene una pregunta.
Okay. Detrás. Sí, sí.
Rafael.
Oh, perdón.
I'm inspired to hear the stories you're telling us both from the Bronx and from Venezuela. And so one of the things that I was listening also is, and I think that is important, is what I've learned of the indigenous movement, say the Zapatistas and Chiapas who are here nowadays, is that it's very important, memory, that's the word, memory, remember. And going through that, I'm remembering now that back in the 70s, we heard that that something new was happening. And what it was is, has a name, and I'm going to say it because I haven't heard it in a long time, and I think there is something to it. It's called neoliberalism. And it was invented by a good friend
Milton. Mi compadre Milton.
Milton Friedman. It was invented by him in 1942, but it didn't work. A lot of shit was happening. So not until 1971, he brings it up again as an example, and then it was taken in full force in 1982 by Reagan and Thatcher. So it's neoliberalism what we have a crisis of right now, and it's neoliberalism what, like the compañero was saying, makes us, that we have capitalism in our blood and bones, he said. Mine started aching, but it's true. That was the plan of neoliberalism. If you read about it, then you can see that actually you are discovering that we have to break away from that. But what is it? So here comes the next idea. Very important is that neoliberalism created, like Pupayero said here, and I was surprised to hear that say the entire system of science, for example, in New York, is controlled by neoliberalism. It was planned, it's designed, and it's very, very difficult to get out of it. if you're going to have like a sustainability in the sense that we saw in that video, then we need scientists, engineers, or whatever, you know, people with ingenuity, creativity, that was great, that was great, and also people with know-how. The Zapatistas used all a bunch of scientists to study for people. That's very interesting. So I would propose that we, like the compañera says, as a, you know, in our spare time, take over this study of this, the memory of who I was, what is, and what is going to be in the future. I see that we're living is the crisis, so it didn't work. It made things even worse. But what I see is that, for example, Trump is a response to the crisis of neoliberalism, but in a different way. And it was coming, and it had to come. But anyway, thank you.
Gracias a usted. Thank you. The brother in the back has been waiting.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about, we've been talking a lot about how do we do this, you know? There's a protesting word, and our hands don't have calluses because a lot of us, you know, work with our mouth. And when you said about the hands, everybody looked at their hands because they weren't even sure which side they were at, you know? So over the past years, you know, I've been working with the land. I've been working on doing urban agriculture. We took some classes, you know, went to Mexico, did some things over there, came back, and I've been working doing that. And even me, and like we keep breaking the barriers of our mentality, of the kind of mentality. I was speaking to one of the uncles the other day, and I was telling my plans about agriculture and, you know, even this and even that. And my uncle tells me, it doesn't matter how many gardens you grow in the city, because the food you're gonna grow is gonna only have a little bit of spirit. And the food that you buy at the stores has no spirit. It's like food needs to grow in its natural habitat to have that spirit, because when you eat it, you're eating, you know, you're feeding yourself, you know, spiritual nutrition instead of just that, you know? So in my head, I was like, this is garden, we keep bees, and we're gonna make our own social economy. And you know, it's falling back into the colonized mentality of you said, what is the solution at the end? What do you get? And I'm worrying about how am I gonna economically be okay? You know, I'm trying to be who I really want to be in this kind of system. So when we talk about things like this, it's really hard to envision how does this work, because when we envision it, as Susie said, we got to go back to living in the land all the way, where we hunt and meat, and, you know, we can grow some more food, but it has to be grown in the wild, or the spirits, you know, gnomes, whatever, you can put the spirit in there, you know, kill that food. So living in the city, growing up in the city, is really hard to make that vision. Because the vision that you have at the end is what your work is going to follow. And if you don't follow that, you yourself are going to know you're not following that vision at the end. So I don't have an answer. You know, I don't know, I'm still trying to figure it out. But as of now, I am in the city, I am in Chicago, I'm not going nowhere. And I'm with my people. And even us, thinking of like, well, now we're the International Indigenous Youth Council, we got a lot of, we're in the limelight, you know? People are talking about listening to us. And we had the opportunity to become a non-for-profit. And even as an organization, we're thinking, is that the way we want to go? Because yeah, having that IOIC name is going to benefit us, because we get funds, grants, and you know, we already recognize. But that's again, I don't want a grant. I don't want that. I don't want my money to come from a grant from the build. We'll use it to get off our feet. Do I really want to get off my feet? You know, these questions. And right now, even as an organization, we're trying to understand, where is our base coming from? Where are our values coming from? And this is the Micha Danchalani Mashika here. It's a five kali, five house. It's the house of the foundation. Where are your values? Where are your morals? For when you build this foundation, where are you going? Mm. So I don't have an answer. It's just my thoughts about things that you guys are saying, everything that everyone's having to say. And that is kind of where I'm at, and so on a personal level. And that's what I'm building with my community. I just want to put that out.
Appreciate that, bro. You wanna?
First of all, thanks for your presentation, your talk that has been very informative, educational, and have been, well, is able to have this discussion, people contributing, which is very important. I think it's what we really need today. And by the same time, to act, not just discussion, not just talk, to act. And in that sense, learning also about what you are saying, the difference between communication and information, which was very important to hear from you guys today, what is going on here in this country. But I would like to ask you, if you get a high school kid, if you get a college student even, and they said, oh, you're coming from Venezuela, so how can you tell me about Venezuela? Why is Bolivarian Revolution still there? Why can you tell me what are the two or three most important points, positive points, that you saw in your visit to Venezuela?
That's an awesome. That's an awesome question. Awesome question. I would. For me, the main thing that I've even gotten from just the entire, being able to witness the process in the last decade plus of the Bolivarian Revolution is, once somebody realizes that they can have a say in their future, once somebody realizes that they have the power to be able to determine how they live, to be able to determine their level of dignity, to be able to have a say in constructing their reality, you can never take that away from them again. And I think that's been the biggest victory of the revolution over there. Over here, we are, especially our young people, we're consistently being told, this is how you're supposed to look. This is the music you're supposed to listen to. This is, the latest fashion that you're supposed to follow. And I think that over there, as we're seeing with these guys who during the Chavez years were teens and in their 20s. And today, they're adults, some of them like us in their 30s, having families. But the situation may be changing in Venezuela every day. But one thing that they can't take away from them, that the economic war can't take away from them, that the empire can't take away from them, is that feeling that you have the ability to determine your future. And over here, I think some of the biggest things that we battle is, not caring. Like, they control the weather. Like, why am I even going to, they got chemtrails and all this other stuff, or HAARP or whatever stuff. Like, why are we even going to go fight the fight? I'm just going to go over here and, watch a movie and relax when it's a helpless fight, And I think that there's a reason why those ideas are pushed, because it makes people want to feel helpless. But I would tell young people that, if you're in a stage, you're moving forward in life, and you want to be able to determine what your family looks like. We even like you said, brother, your name is Carlos in the back? Yeah, we don't have the solutions. We're in process, even us. We have our young families, and we're trying to figure out how we're going to live. How do we, step outside of this system and be able to start to determine our future? You feel me? And not be beholden to different sources of power that don't have our interests in mind. You know what I'm saying? So that's what I would say.
Maybe that's something related to what you're talking about. My name is Jesus Rodriguez. I'm the Consul General from Venezuela, so maybe some of you might know about it, but I usually go and do public engagements, speak in front of schools, colleges, and things like that, and they usually ask me about what happened in Venezuela. I try to be as frank as I can, and I'm usually very frank. But another thing that I forgot sometimes to mention in these questions and these things that Gonzalo was talking about remind me of is the fact that Hugo Chavez seems in Venezuelans our sense of dignity. And sometimes when I'm talking about the bad situation that we are facing right now, maybe it's not nice talking about those things in face of the material challenges that we are facing. But the truth is that dignity and that sense of pride of being right now independent, of being right now we Venezuelans and the Venezuelan government doing things not for the good of corporation or for the good of a few ones, but for the good of the people, make a lot of us feel like it's worth it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We feel that the sense of sovereignty, of autodetermination, worth all the problems that we are facing. So I don't want to say with this that we still need to face more economic troubles, but it's a fact that that is not only in my way of thinking, but I know that that's for sure in the way of thinking of a lot of Venezuelans that realize that it's better what we have now than what we had before. So I just wanted to add that.
For sure. And Andy, you want to get the last word in? If I don't think anybody else.
I might. I think I have something I haven't heard. I think that we have to realize we are living in an abundant world. And for the first time in world history, we could be freed from slave labor, wage labor, or those kinds of horrible conditions that preceded us. You know, that this era that we're coming into is a revolutionary time. It's a technological revolution. It's undeniable. And one of the things is that they pay based on what the average necessary human labor time is, like we were talking about the other day. They see a reserve army of people over here. They say, well, I can get one of you nine idiots for $5 an hour. And if you don't like it, I'll go out for him six or something. They play us like that for years and years. Now, they don't need millions of us. And that holds true in China, holds true in South America, holds true in Europe, it holds true in the U.S. So their calculation is, how do we keep private property while knowing full well the system of capitalism won't work anymore because the wage labor depends on buying people's labor power. You don't need their labor power. You don't need them. They're redundant. You figure out a way to get rid of them. So we're in a fight to actually go back to collectivizing everything, like the indigenous people. We were going to have it a socialism or communism at a higher level than ever been history in the world. Or we're going to perish because these idiots are going to pollute every damn body of water. They're going to poison the air and all that crap. So, I mean, it's a life or death choice for us in the macro picture. Now, in the micro picture, we got to do what we got to do to survive every day. And, like, I look at the people in my neighborhood, some of them, they're worried about somebody selling loose cigarettes like Eric Garner. So I'm like, what the hell are you worried about that guy trying to make a little bit of money to keep bread on his table? You should be worried about that son of a bitch downtown who covered up a murder. That's what you should be worried about.
Yeah.
So I think we have to walk on both feet, as they say.
Yeah.
We have to survive. Our family's got to eat. We got to do all that. But we have to study this era that we're living in, because this is unprecedented in the history of the world.
Man, I'm so glad you said that, just to speak to that, because the brother, the comrade, you were talking about neoliberalism being in crisis, and I feel like what Andy's speaking to is kind of that long look. And we have to be clear, the enemy, they don't have 2-year plans, 5-year plans, they got 50-year plans. So how can we strategize anything if we don't have a plan? You know, and I think that part of some of these local cooperatives and stuff that we were showing in Venezuela, they're engaged in a process where they're dealing with their everyday survival and the lack of specific things, maybe like toiletries and this and that. But in creating that organic, they're looking forward into how they're going to live and sustain themselves and be able to create a network where they're connecting with other cooperatives and collectives throughout the country and really throughout the world, as our work over there, shows. But I definitely think that's the reality, man. Like, the crisis in neoliberalism, the army of the unemployed is no longer needed. So what happens, when, millions of us become redundant because of robotics and automation? That is right around the corner. You know, my daughter, who is 3 months old, is going to be living in that world, where there's driverless vehicles and all this these ingenuities of modern life, while at the same time there's billions of people that are, you know, living off of less than a dollar a day. So I definitely I'm feeling that the idea of having a long view of where we're going, especially in the era where millions of people are going to be deemed disposable, literally. You know what I'm saying? And how do we survive in that space, for sure? So, well, we want to keep this dialogue going, but I know we got a short time here in the space, but we want to thank y'all for being here. Hopefully we could maybe pass something on real quick so we have some folks' information. We definitely want to keep building. We made a call out, and thank you, brothers from the Indigenous Council, for being here today, and sisters as well. We made a call out also to different people in that are doing media in Chicago, because we want to build with y'all. So let's connect. The folks are doing media communications work. We got a plan, and we want to share it with y'all. So let's build.